The following program is a production of KHNS. Its content does not necessarily reflect the views or opinions of the Board of Directors and staff of Lincoln-L Broadcasting Incorporated, the licensee.
And welcome to Talk Around Town. I'm Deborah Schnabel, your guide through today's talk about community matters. Here's the rundown. We'll start the biweekly news review with Tom Morfitt, the editor of the Choquette Valley News. And our talking topic today is government jurisdiction on public lands. Can safety be regulated? Our guests include borough tour permittees Nick Trimble and Scott Sundberg of SEBA, and Tracy Knutson, an attorney specializing in defense of extreme sports. Tracy will join us by telephone from Homer. We'll check in with the Lincoln-L community players and Hey, Who Are You? Introduces us to another community member. We'll also be introducing PM Forney's 15th Rule of Considerate Conduct. So, let's get on with it. And a good morning to you, Mr. Morfitt.
Good morning, Deborah.
How are you today? You look rested. You look very rested.
Well, thank you. Yeah. We had a couple busy weeks in
the
news.
We have, yes.
Yeah. I was thinking this morning that our community, I was comparing our community in my mind to my first record player, and it has, you know, the speeds you could play a record at were 16, 33, 45, and 78. Those four, there were the four speeds on your record player. And I think, you know, just like our record player, we're usually at 33. Sometimes in the winter it gets down to 16 and we're on. Oh, and now we're up to about 45. And usually by about May, we're at full 78.
It has been a very busy 2 weeks for me also. A lot of meetings, a lot of putting things together. There's budgets, there's policies, they're looking at life in general. So tell us like it is.
Yeah. Well, I'd say for the probably third or fourth winter, heli skiing is the topic. Both its regulation in terms of where they fly and in the past 3 years, the deaths, these fatalities. Last Saturday, fourth fatality in three seasons. Guide at the Kicking Horse trapped in an avalanche, which has basically been the story in safety. And so, again, the town is grappling with this, wondering where the public plays in, what the operators are doing. I know you're going to address that later in the show. Mm-hmm. So I'm not going to go there. I also have an editorial in this week's paper about this issue because I think it is a public issue. Mm-hmm. But I kind of wanted to revisit that 10-hour meeting last week because
– The two-day meeting?
Because there was so much going on there.
There was a lot.
And of course, in print, we can only cover a certain amount of it and kind of what are the biggest issues. But, you know,
You're talking about Tuesday, March 14th.
The Tuesday-Wednesday meeting.
And then it went on to Wednesday. Right. And prior to that, there was a 2-hour, 15-minute Commerce Committee meeting also.
Right.
So that was an 8.5-hour session for me starting at 4 o'clock.
Yeah. And most people don't go to public meetings, even when there's 50 mm-hmm. people there. Right? It's just a tiny fraction of our community. And just for the folks that aren't there, it was interesting to me the people who were there, who were from different industries – different neighborhoods mm-hmm, in this mm-hmm. in our community, mm-hmm. and saying mostly the people who turned out that they didn't want that activity, didn't want to see or hear mm-hmm. helicopters in their neighborhoods. And these are not just what we call maybe the usual suspects who we say, oh, ascribe, oh, those are just the anti-development people. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. People who are, I would generally describe as fairly pro-development. And then later in the meeting, mm-hmm. it became obvious that even canoe tours on Mosquito Lake mm-hmm. are very controversial in the mm-hmm. neighborhood. Now, these mm-hmm. are non-motorized canoes. Mm-hmm. And that it's been proposed twice before, and the neighbors have come out and said, we don't want canoe tours in our neighborhood. And it's in fact, Bart Henderson, who had a very successful company, was the last person to propose those canoe tours, mm-hmm. and they were opposed.
On Mosquito Lake?
At Mosquito Lake.
I was unaware of that.
And yeah, the big canoes at one time, he suggested putting it on there, and the residents came out and said, no, we don't want it. And then also last week we had...
I do want to add to that, though, because I was present at that meeting, and I thought that whole canoe thing, that not to deny, I mean, you are right, there were people who didn't want canoe tours, but I think that a larger, more heard argument was the ability to manage the use between motorized and non-motorized in the slough itself, getting the canoes in and out. There seemed to be a safety issue there.
Right. But I don't believe that was the reason it sunk it in previous proposals. And then we heard from Clockwan as well, concerned about the tours that go by Clockwan. And this all goes back. I think it's time we, again, kind of work on this issue, it seems to me, because back when the cruise ships stopped coming, when Royal Caribbean stopped coming here, a person came to our town who was an academic, Lee Severny was her name, and she wrote a piece and she said this town is not dealing with its tours very well. And the residents want one thing, the business community wants another thing, and the town's not resolving it. And the community and Arnie Olson, of all people, who was very involved on the tour side, read her account and said, she's right.
Get that republished.
Well,
bring it out.
I guess we could.
I think that's true. That's almost a decade old. I mean, more than a decade.
Yeah,
because that'd be the late. Mid to late 90s, I think, when the Royal Caribbean came out.
But I think if you look at the issue, it's not just about helicopters.
No.
It's about tours in people's neighborhoods.
It's about land use.
And land use.
And I remember Jerry Ernie stood up in the back of the room and talked about, neighbors and how he talked about community. Mm-hmm. That's what he talked about. And it rang with me, mm-hmm. It's like, how do you get along? Goodness. And when you draw your lines, even around your own family, when you live in a house, you got to figure out how to negotiate. You got to figure out how to share the bathroom and share the hallways and share the yard. And, it's all a real interesting exercise.
Yeah. And I guess I think it's particularly a hard issue in Alaska because we're real private property people. We're privacy people. I mean, that's the nature of the people that come up here, stake out their little piece of ground, and that's their kingdom.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas down south, you have your house. It's just an addition to your life. But our identities are very wrapped up, I think, in this part of the world, in our homes, in our little homesteads that we build.
And in our territory.
Yeah.
And what's so interesting is later today when we check in on Mr. Fournier's, rules of civility, one of them is to respect other people's space.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And knowing the boundaries, knowing your territory, where does my line stop and your line begin?
Yeah. Yeah.
That's really an interesting issue.
Okay. Another thing I want to point out in the news, very interesting this week. Next weekend, the school district, the school board plans to hire a new superintendent.
Next weekend?
Next weekend.
Okay.
And several places where the public can participate and have their input known to the board before the hire is made. Already, the district has two finalists. Now, Michael Beyer, the current superintendent, gave his resignation in February 6th or 5th or 6th. Mm-hmm. Less than 2 months later, the district is looking at making a hire. Now, compare that to our chief of police and our manager hires, which dragged on for months. And you have to ask, why? What's the difference there?
Yeah, do you have an idea?
I really don't. The reason that the school wants to accelerate the process is right now there's about 7 or 8 districts apparently statewide, including Petersburg, Mount Edgecombe, who are also looking for superintendents. They wanted to get their advertisement out and their process done so that the relative pool of candidates to choose from would still be big before these guys start going elsewhere. Mm-hmm. But it certainly is a stark contrast to the laborious process, or what appeared to be a laborious process, for those other two positions. Now, the district did not seek a recruiter, which is a big issue for the assembly, whether they should find a firm to help them make this hire. And, of course, in a 2-month hire, we'll see. I mean, the proof is in the pudding. Maybe there are just more qualified, interested applicants in the superintendent realm than there are in the manager or police chief realm.
I don't know about that. Right.
Yeah.
It is a difficult thing. I don't know. I know that in Southeast Alaska right now, many people who are being hired into municipal management positions have no municipal management experience. I learned that when I attended Southeast Conference this last week.
Yeah.
So, well, thanks very much, Tom. There's a lot going on.
Thanks, Deb. I can't wait to hear the rest of the show.
Me too. Do you have a story to tell? The Lynn Canal Community Players wants to hear it. And we're checking in this week with Annette Smith of the Lynn Canal Community Players about an interesting new platform, Storytelling, that's being launched tonight, I think. That's right. So welcome, Annette.
Yep.
And tell us, what is River Talk all about?
Well, it's a storytelling program, and we're sort of looking at this as a wintertime activity. But we believe there's two more months left of winter.
So, you do?
So believe it or else. So this is the first one is this Thursday, March 20th.
That's
at
tonight.
7 p.m. at the Chilkat Center lobby. And then the next one will be April 10th, which is also a Thursday. And this is an opportunity for us to come together and share stories of our lives and our community. And these stories we look at as kind of our oral history, told by the people who live here or who visit in this valley. Stories flow and meander like a river, and our mighty rivers,
river
the Chilkat and the Chilkoot, yes, and their tributaries have probably inspired many stories or seen many stories. So that's where we came up
now
with River Talk.
Okay, so I think that I had heard that this has been done in other communities. Is it called River Talk in other communities too?
Well, we got the idea. We got the idea from Juneau, and they call their storytelling program the Mud Room.
Oh.
And it's also been done in Anchorage, and that's called Arctic Entry. For some reason, they believe that all the good stories are told in the Mud Room.
Okay.
But we think River Talk has
Cunny
better.
Chuck. In Barrow, yeah. It would be called Cunny Chuck.
But they've really taken off. And everybody loves them. It's really a fun evening.
So I understood from reading the poster that you expect people to sign up. So tonight is the night. Have you got people signed up to tell stories?
That's right. Each month we hope to have 7 people tell the stories. And we ask them to sign up in advance, so that we know that we have a program.
Sure.
And they tell a story on a particular theme that's chosen for that month. So this month it's breakup. And we hope that the theme can be interpreted in many ways.
Yes, I was wanting to ask you specifically sort of breakup are you speaking about?
Well, that's the idea.
Divorces
if it's
the story of my divorce.
If it's interpreted in many ways, we'll get many different kinds of stories. So breakup, we were imagining, of course, spring breakup, but as we know around in this community, that can also be breakup of marriages.
Hand in hand, right.
But you can think of many different ways to interpret breakup. And sometimes you may have a story and you just want to tell it so you can somehow work it around to the theme of the
So
month.
Do you have people signed up for tonight?
Do we have
do
a
have
lineup
7?
Of 7 people.
Oh, you do? All right. So it will be a full night. I was wondering about whether or not we were going to be pulling people out of the audience.
No. We need to.
to tell your story. Okay. Terrific.
So these stories can be funny, sad, thought-provoking, or even chilling. But whatever.
Do you expect people to write them out, or do you expect people to just come and tell the story from notes or...
We're not expecting professional storytellers, but we don't really. But it's when you go on the Chilkat Center website, chilkatcenter.org, there are some tips for making your presentation, and I think they do suggest that you write it out. We don't suggest that you have a script.
Right.
But you could have some notes or something like that.
Okay. Yeah. And what about falling short of 7 minutes? Is there a penalty for that?
Oh, no, no, no. That's the maximum.
Okay.
Yes. Tonight we're going to have a poem. Mm-hmm. By Tamsin Cassidy, and she told me that's about 2 minutes long.
Okay.
But it'll be good.
All right.
You can bet.
You bet. That's wonderful.
And we'll also have music by local musicians and some refreshments. Mm-hmm. And for this first opener, we're going to serve beer and wine as well.
All right.
So it'll be a fun evening.
All right. Great. And that starts at 7 o'clock at the Chilkat
Center. Can I say that where you can contact people?
For what?
To sign up?
Sure.
Email lccplayers@hotmail.com or call 766-2708. And as I mentioned, chilkatcenter.org is where you can find out more about River Talk.
Okay. And before we close out today, we wanted to check in also with Lincoln Canal Community Players for the plans for the Summer's Conservatory Theater.
Right. That's the Summer Youth Theater Conservatory, LCCP's Summer Theater Camp. And that's 3 weeks of theater fun. And where the kids learn all about theater. They learn voice, movement, acting, and all about the aspects of play production. And at the end of the 3 weeks, they put on a full-length theater production on the main stage of the Chilkat Center. And this year, the dates are June 30th to July 20th, with the production happening the 18th and the 19th. It's for children ages 8 to 18, and then we have a halftime playmaking session for kids ages 5 to 7.
How many years has this been going on?
Oh, golly, I don't even know.
But 10?
I know it started back in the 90s when my kids were involved.
Yeah, it's a fantastic program. I really think it's a great program.
And the DDF people really love to have graduates of the theater.
Yeah, and we have local people who have pursued careers in theater as a result of participating in the Summer Conservatory. So I really think it's a great program. When do people sign up for this? By when, I guess? When's the deadline?
Okay, well, the deadline is the day of. But we offer a pre-registration discount for registration before June 6th.
Okay.
And this year, we're really lucky to have Dr. Stanley Coleman as the director. He comes from Lane College in Eugene, Oregon.
Oh, Jeff Young. Jeff Young's stomping ground.
Yeah, and now Dan Henry. And Dan Henry was the one who suggested him. So he has a doctorate in theater. So we think he'll be able to get across to our kids the excitement of drama and theater. And he also ran a children's theater for several years in Thibodaux, Louisiana.
Mm-hmm.
So I have to say what we're going to do. We're going to do The Mad Adventures of Mr. Toad.
Hmm. Wow.
With a children's adaptation of The Wind in the Willows. Does anybody know The Wind in the Willows?
Sure.
Mr. Toad, this is a wild romp with lots of action.
Great. Okay. All right. Well, thanks very much. You guys have a busy summer ahead, and Lincoln Canal Community Players does a lot for the community. I'm very glad you're here.
Well, thank you, Deborah.
So tonight, I hope everybody shows up at the Chilkat Center to take participate in the first annual River Talk.
Well, I think it'll be fun to listen to as well.
Thanks. Experienced guide employed in the heli-ski industry in Haines died this week in an avalanche. This marks the fourth death by avalanche in 3 consecutive seasons, and for many local people, this signals a need to begin a serious inquiry into what should be done or could be done to minimize risks for recreational operators and clients in mountainous terrain. The Haines Borough currently permits heli-ski tours operating within the borough on state lands. And today, I want to explore the question of jurisdiction and whose responsibility is it, if anyone's, to minimize risk and loss of life. Does a local government have the legal standing to regulate commercial activities on public lands? And if so, what responsibilities would a government assume? Or is it left up to the industry? Southeast Alaska Backcountry Adventures is not the only operator that has suffered loss of friend, employee, or client. But because SEBA has experienced the ordeal in two consecutive years, we've invited the principals Nick Trimble and Scott Sundberg to talk with us about this today. Nick will not be joining us, but Scott Sundberg is here with us in the studio to now. But I want to talk about how the experience has impacted SEBA's operations and how we might make heliskiing an enterprise with less risk. Welcome, Scott. Thanks for joining us today. And we can assume and appreciate your sensitivities and your vulnerabilities right now and so soon after the accident. But so it's really appreciated that you're willing to talk with us today. And I also have on board today via telephone from Homer, Tracy Knutson. Tracy's a defense attorney. She just specializes in recreation and adventure sports. So Knutson and Associates is providing advice and support to SEBA on land use issues. In addition to an active practice, Tracy has authored several legal treatises on outdoor program administration and risk mitigation, and she's a producer or a co-producer and publisher of two DVDs called State of Risk, Risk Management in the Outdoor Industry, and Essential Risk Management Practices for Your Recreation and Adventure Travel Business. She advises and litigates on the state and federal level, so I want to welcome Tracy. Are you there with us?
I am.
All right. Thank you. You are a bit. And also, interestingly, I just want to say that at 9:22 this morning, I also received a correspondence from Sean Brunel, the co-owner of Alaska Heliskiing, who heard that we were on having the show about safety today, and he wants to he's not going to participate physically, but he has sent some correspondence that I probably will want to read a little bit later in the program when we get more to the topic at hand. But I want to explore policy issues for government interaction with the industry in this program. But I think first we need to address some more immediate questions for SEBA. So we're going to first off get some perspective. The Colorado Avalanche Information Center, that's a peer group clearinghouse for the industry, reports 24 avalanche deaths nationwide so far this season. One of them is in Alaska, and that's here in Haines. And the prior season attributed 24 deaths nationwide to avalanches. Again, one of those was in Alaska, and that was in Haines. And in 2011-12, there were 34 deaths by avalanche or attributed to avalanche in Alaska. Two of those were in Alaska, and both of those were in Haines. So in the two prior consecutive years, there were five deaths due to avalanches in Alaska, but none of them were in Haines. So it's interesting that all Haines deaths were merchandised, they're called merchandised guided clients. And in other words, the accidents were suffered by clients or people in a commercial guiding business. None of the avalanche deaths in Alaska outside of Haines were commercial. So the Haines heliski industry operated for many, many years without any fatalities. So I'd like to ask Tracy or Scott, probably you, Scott, here. So what has happened or what has changed, do you think, that might explain the increased incidences of accidents in the heliski business in the last 3 years?
There's a lot of, obviously a lot of variables. We have topics like global weather conditions, increased participation. You could add many levels of this. Mm-hmm. They're hard to explain or give weight to, and we could spend time doing it. But I think that the inherent risk of heliskiing dictates that there will be some accident someday. And, we had... in Haines, no fatalities for the first 10 years. And so, probability says, well, at some point in time, there's going to be something that happens. And we prepare for this. We know that there will be something that happens no matter how hard we work towards safety and designing a system that works to keep everybody safe.
One of the things that was proposed to me earlier was it's kind of like that perfect storm kind of syndrome where the industry was built up during a series of excellent or great weather conditions, and the last couple of years we're on some other kind of a cycle. Would you say that might be a part of it, the factor? I mean, did you grow your industry at a time when everything was like perfect?
No.
Oh, okay.
No, but I will say that we have seen different weather conditions that aren't normal. And when I say that, you could take it in within a 20-year or 25-year cycle because, you know, Alaska received excessively warm and rainy conditions in January. And all over the state, people were saying, wow, I've never seen this before. But, you know, you look, the meteorologists look back and say, well, actually, it, you know, there's four other times it was actually worse or it has happened and these are the dates. Mm-hmm. And they're staggered, you know, 20 years, 25 years.
Mm-hmm. So well, it does. Deborah, you know, if I could interject
sure.
a little
mm-hmm.
bit, I want us to be careful in the discourse that we bring to the public so that it's informative. I think looking at pockets of incidents or single incidents is a little bit misleading. You know, generally what we do in the recreation industry, whether it is commercial heli skiing or rotor-assisted skiing or it's climbing or rafting, is we look at overall numbers, which are commercial user days, as against the number of injurious episodes that we see. And, you know, we want to be careful also in making a representation that heli skiing is a young industry, because it really is not a young industry. It's an industry that's been in existence on the North American continent for 50 years. And if you look at commercial user days, I mean, we've got in excess of 200,000 commercial user days among the Canadian operators. We've got 30 Canadian operators. We've got about 15 U.S. operators. So I think the question has to be recharacterized a little bit. Have we seen an increase in overall accidents over those commercial user days? And I would have to say no. And go ahead.
Yeah, I understand that, and I can absolutely appreciate. I'm not a statistician, but I know enough to know that you can't just zero in on one isolated place. But at the same time, I think that we are, and I am asking you to recognize too that, you know, we are a small community where everybody, you know, an incident occurs, and it's not something that we just see on the television set and not know who's involved or engaged. And so it hits us all a lot harder. It's not just statistics. So the conversation kind of develops. And I think that Scott represented that, you know, fairly, that we do see things, you know, have to see it within context. Because I didn't really look, you know, at the didn't look at it statistically to say percentage wise, are we seeing more deaths per capita? Obviously the business is growing, or I think that the business is growing. There's more client days, you know, operating as, you know, in the valley today than there were 5 years ago, for example. So, you know, we know we're going to see more action and more activity, but, you know, we want to move forward, I think, to talking to about, okay, you know, what do we have? What can we work with in the community to help mitigate some of that feeling, you know, of anxiety, I guess, about the industry? So I think that, one of the things that happened in 2013, last year, I know, as the borough, some of borough officials, questioned why we were requiring applicants for heliski permits to even file a safety plan with the borough, because no one in the borough had any expertise to determine whether the plan had merit. We didn't know if we could enforce it. So the borough, who was a permitting agency, began to look around to the industry for standards of operation. And there are schools offering certification in avalanche and outdoor snow safety and all. So there, I know that the industry holds a high regard for education and for safety, but I want to ask you, Scott, as a business owner, I know you're dealing with people who come here because the mountains are steep, the snow is great, you know, I mean, they want the thrill of heliskiing. Is there a culture of safety in the industry for you as a business person? And how did you react last year to the death? Did you start to do anything differently? Did you modify your plans, your operational plans, that sort of thing? What do you do to deal with this inherent risk?
Right. I guess backtracking a little, this CAIC reported the 2013 death as an avalanche. It was not an avalanche. It was a what we call a cornice fall. So that an avalanche didn't create the situation. But in reactions to that, we worked closely with Alaska OSHA and consulted with them and tried to figure out what we could do to establish better guidelines.
The Operational Safety and Health Administration, the federal OSHA, is that what you're talking about? The state level, yes.
Okay. And they came in and they reviewed the case of a workplace fatality. And then we took it back to ourselves and said, hey, what can we do to improve as a company to make sure that we provide or give an opportunity to make the safest workplace out there without inhibiting the natural or habitual ways people operate in the mountains? If you encase them in a wall of glass, so to speak, or a exoskeleton so nothing happens to them, can they perform their job? You know, there's certain things we cannot do that, you know, it pretty much takes out the ability to do the job. So,
excuse me, are you talking about like?
I'm just saying that
an outfit, right? I mean, like, I just watched the movie Gravity, and I saw these people trying to fix the
right
spaceship, and they had so many clothes on, I couldn't figure out how they could even move.
That's what we're talking about: is mobility and being able to hear and feel and have your sensories is very important as a guide. Subtleties in the snowpack will give you clues that something is not safe or something is up. Mm-hmm. And so if you deaden that those sensibilities, you might be actually creating more risk. And so we took a look at that. We came up with some new programs. We instituted certain helmet mandates, when you should be wearing one, when it's acceptable not to. We also mandated that all guides and clients should be wearing airbags.
Mm-hmm. Now, and then here comes the difficult question is how do you as a business owner, enforce your own regulations, your own things? I mean, it's...
Well, typically management is going to trust people in responsible positions, lead guides that have control of a group of guides that ultimately have control of all the clients, that they are going to uphold the standards of the company. This is an assumed thing, and without... management pretty much just being a complete watchdog. Mm-hmm. You know, we are assuming that these things are happening. Everyone's informed. People have been through safety training and the protocols and procedures of our company, and that those are going to happen.
Right. Guides, some guides pay the ultimate price, but for you as a business owner, are there enforcement rules that you would have if you ever found out that somebody was operating?
Yeah, outside? I mean, if it comes back through, mm-hmm. and it says, hey, you weren't in the field today with what we require you to have. Yeah, there's disciplinary action and then, of course, termination.
Okay. Tracy, I'd like to hear your thoughts on the issue of regulatory jurisdiction. Do you think that the Haynesboro would be wise to attach operating conditions to our permitting procedures? For example, like require tour permittees operating a heliski tour in Haynes to have equipment such as avalungs or airbags or something like that for every client?
Well, the short answer is no, and the explanation for that no or negative response is in any industry, and the one that you're dealing with is heli-skiing, there are always changes in equipment, changes in standards. I mean, Scott just had an interesting discussion about, you know, did they do a review process subsequent to their incident last year? Well, of course, any reasonable and prudent operator reviews internally what happened, figures out if there are pieces that they can put in place. And for a land administrator or a local municipality to take on to themselves the burden of staying abreast of what changes in equipment are occurring in the industry, what changes in operational standards are occurring, what changes in safety standards are occurring, what changes in guiding standards are occurring. And when I make that kind of list or recitation to you, Deborah, what I'm suggesting is there are a lot of different facets to running a business like this. And if the municipality or a local government agency is going to mandate different pieces of the program, by necessity, they are taking on to themselves the duty then to stay abreast of all of those changes, mm-hmm. and they're essentially holding themselves out to have some expertise. And I can observe for you that, you know, certainly we are a litigious country, and over the last 15 years or so, we have seen an increase in all kinds of litigation, and that certainly applies to the recreation arena. But one of the areas, Deborah, that we've seen increased litigation is against public land administrators and oversight agencies. You know, national parks are being sued regularly. Local and state public land administrators are being sued.
Being sued by people that want to use the land differently than the regulations say they can?
Well, in a couple of different senses, there may be people who want to use public lands differently than the land administrator has outlined or designed. That certainly is one aspect. But we also see, Deborah, in situations where people are injured doing recreational activities, if the litigant, if the deceased or injured person decides to litigate against the operator, they may, in addition, add the public land administrator saying, well, listen, you know, had you not required this or had you required that, then this incident wouldn't have occurred. So for a land administrator to take upon themselves this idea that they can oversee changing standards has become, I think, problematic and injected you into that litigation arena in some pretty striking ways. Mm-hmm. So it's not real common for local groups, municipalities, boroughs, to regulate operational issues. It's more common for local groups to tax recreational user groups, just like other businesses are taxed, because when we bring recreational opportunities into local areas, sometimes it adds additional burdens to public services that are offered. Mm-hmm. You know, emergency responders may be required to participate. You may have increased use of certain roadways, things like that. So we'll definitely see local areas tax businesses like any other product, but it isn't real common for them to get into the business of oversight or applying specific standards to businesses.
Sure. Okay. We also recognize, too, that regulation of anything usually develops out of, you know, calamity or death or whatever. I mean, we see hard hats required on job sites, seat belts required in moving cars, survival suits required on fishing boats. You know, there's all kinds of regulation within the mining industry, the construction industry, the aviation industry. So I don't want to feel off base, you know, by asking that even though we're dealing with avalanches that are kind of, you know, natural phenomena, they are human triggered. Is there something that we could do operating in avalanche country to reduce the risks of death by avalanche? And I guess so the question is, if it's not the borough's responsibility to, or as you're advising, we would be stepping into a can of worms, I guess, if we did that. Then where does this kind of regulation come from? Is it reasonable to expect the industry to itself or the businesses to impose their own restrictions and apparently, possibly, lose competitive advantage? I mean, do you struggle with that?
You know, that's and let me jump in ahead of you for a minute, Scott. That's a really articulate question that you're putting forward. To what extent do we see industries self-regulating as against, you know, government entities regulating? And I want to reframe the question, because you're asking to what extent do local municipalities get involved in oversight of operational issues. And so let me say this. it is true that we see regulation, and I think you're very wise to point this out. It's true that we see regulation of industries, safety issues, but that normally is done through groups like OSHA, which Scott just discussed. If OSHA sees that we're employing people in certain areas, they'll come in and do audits or reviews, as was done with SEBA last year. They'll audit safety practices as they affect employees. So then let's switch gears a minute and respond to your question. Is it fair to expect an industry to self-regulate? And I want to say to you, yes, but it's not just because the particular operator will self-regulate. It's because the nature of how recreational products are delivered on public lands creates a sort of self-regulating situation, and that situation is this, Deborah. In order to operate on public lands, what land administrators generally do, their primary function is to require a commercial operator to be in possession of comprehensive general liability insurance. And if they don't have insurance that can respond to incidents, then permits aren't generally issued. The land administrator itself may require that the insurance name the local land administrator as an additional insured so that the land administrator gets some protection from liability. And then what happens, Deborah, is if a particular group, in order to get that insurance, let's back up, in order to get that insurance, the underwriting process to obtain the insurance policy will generally dictate following certain industry standards. So that isn't normally done by a local government entity. It's done when a review of the business is done to obtain liability insurance. And if a business produces multiple incidents, very often it'll find itself in a situation where it loses insurance. So if you don't have insurance, you then lose your permit to operate on public lands. And that's generally how the internal intra-industry policing occurs. And it does occur, and we see that happen pretty frequently. So we shake out smaller groups that aren't capable of keeping up with standards, and that process of forcing a group to obtain recreation insurance in order to have permits is also protective of the land administrator when they follow a normal practice of asking to be named as an additional insured.
Mm-hmm.
And it relieves the local group of having to do oversight.
It seems that Haynes has a... did you want to weigh in on that, Scott, before I moved on?
No, and that's a very...
Certainly it kind of pulls the conversation, you know, more into a analytic realm when we're talking about insurance, which is, you know, the mechanism by which, in a way, it's kind of a moderator. Because the thing that I had been thinking about earlier, and it was almost a more commercial kind of idea, that the reputation that we have here in Haynes for both extreme adventure and extreme risk, I think, they kind of come together. And it seems that the community, we want somehow to reconcile those elements. And I don't know that we can reconcile those elements, I guess. It's been commented to me that, as much as I hate to say it out loud, that, for some people, the fact that there is great risk, that's what's attractive. And that's what makes the industry, continue, I guess, as I was unaware, as Tracy said, that we've had heliskiing as a recreational pursuit for 50 years. I was unaware of that. But we've only had it in our community, I think, for, you know, a little more than a decade, I suppose. I don't know, you can correct me on that. But I want to take it back to kind of the arena, and I really appreciate what Tracy had to say, that insurance can be the balancing factor here, or the one that filters out safety issues. But everyone knows that avalanche danger is high this year everywhere. And we've seen 24 deaths nationwide, and we're only about a third into the season so far. In some areas, the Heliski season goes up until June. So I want to talk about, if you're willing, Scott, about the competitive nature of the industry. Like, how do other operators react to news of avalanche danger and death from one location to the other? Are clients loyal to an area, or how do you deal with it? I can imagine, you know, being unnerved, not just by the death, but by the consequences of how do you go on managing your business with this issue when you have your investments and you have a business, and how do you make it run? You know, some people just aren't willing to be in the business for this very reason that you're in right now, you know, but you're in the business. So,
yeah, that is
do you get callous?
maybe callous in some ways, but not insensitive or insensitive. Mm-hmm. I think that, you know, other operators, we've talked to operators in the area locally. We've talked to operators in other parts of Alaska. We've, you know, communicated to them what has happened here, and it helps them, you know, make sure that we said, hey, be on your toes. We think that we were proceeding correctly here, and still we had an incident. Mm-hmm. And we know that there are some areas in this Alaska, you know, area that have been problematic, different weather patterns, what have you. And this is inherent. We deal with some aspect of this every year. And that's why, you know, we probably come to the borough and ask for more area, because, you know, it's really based on statistics and probability, and more area is better. But We forecast this, we push it forward, and then after something like this happens, you know, as far as clients, some of them, you know, call up and say, hey, you know, this is really kind of unnerving. I don't think I can enjoy coming up there and doing this with you this year. I think I'll be on edge the whole time. Mm-hmm. What can we do to adjust this? You know, others, and this could be maybe a European take, they definitely have a different culture. Europeans are in the mountains all the time in Europe, and they have this freer sense of things. There's not a litigious environment, and they just kind of move on, you know, unless they knew the individual.
Mm-hmm.
So there's kind of multiple levels here. And
yeah, I want to right now introduce this letter from Sean Brunel, because it touches on the issue that you just raised, and that is the industry recently asked for additional territory to mitigate, or to I guess spread the risk around, because everyone knew that the conditions were poor. So Sean, who was not invited to be on the program, but he heard that it was on, and so he sent me a letter this morning, and I do want to read it. This is excerpts. It says, I generally don't say a whole lot unless I think it's absolutely necessary, and I accept the decisions that are made by the borough, and I believe I do my best to be a good Heliski neighbor. This is from Sean Brunel of Alaska Heliskiing. The Heliski industry came to the borough asking for help. We've lost so much terrain over the years. Few choices remain in challenging years like this one. Our safest and most gentle glacier-free ski slopes were skied in the past, have been removed from the ski map. We recognize we needed some of the gentle and non-glaciated terrain back this season to operate safely, but we were denied. I'm not pointing a finger at anyone or defending the actions of those involved with the incident. I believe everyone from the ski industry, all those who pose it, and those who govern it, it all contributed to the creation of an atmosphere for tragedies like this one to occur. Before you start the show, please take the time to consider how everyone could have played a role in this unfortunate event. What is a real solution that is not blurred by an industry's hidden agenda or the opposition's scapegoat? Should the borough manage state land? If the borough played a role in creating an atmosphere where tragedies like this can happen, could the borough be held partly responsible? I don't know the answer to that, but it's something I've been wondering about for a while. And that's from Sean Brunel. And It struck me as something, as kind of a perspective, as seeing a triangular participation, you know, in the Helsinki industry. You have the users or the businesses and the industry. We have the borough, it's trying, and the state and BLM, you know, trying to, as the owners of the resource in a way, to greater or lesser degree. And I think this show has helped clarify for me that we're talking about a borough trying to manage usage on state lands, and there's kind of an irony there. And then we have those who oppose the industry. So I want to talk about, and we don't have very much time, just 3 minutes left, but I want to talk about heliskiing as being hazardous to one's health, Scott. Okay. So Haynes is featured in scores of magazines that print articles and about chasing the adrenaline rush. I mean, there's so many magazines that are out there. Every day one seems to be published. Now, in the January 2012 issue of Snowboarder magazine, a skier named Jamie Lynn says, "There's no truer feeling of being alive than to put yourself in the face of death." Now, some people say that our concerns for mitigating risks are due to the American culture of litigation, and as you've already said, that Europeans take death in extreme sports more in stride. But I hope, Scott, that you'd be just willing here in the final moments to comment on this aspect of extreme sports. Are we cultivating an activity that asks us to get used to people dying?
No more than surfing or swimming in Florida when you get eaten by a shark. I mean... you know, people are out there. They already have these feelings, these passions to do these things. We're trying to make it as safe as possible. You know, there are stats out there that say, 84% or so of fatalities on public lands happen unguided. So the guiding is here to actually assist in reducing deaths, because people are going to go out, access the land, and in some people's opinion, do something crazy. Other people, it's very calculated, and they know exactly what they're doing. And especially the pros, people that have extreme talents, but they're the ones that also, in a probability speaking sense, put themselves at risk more often, therefore creating a higher probability that something might happen. Mm-hmm. But I think the guiding industry ultimately helps reduce the numbers and limits the exponential growth of this culture of, you know, getting people used to dying. I think there'd be more, mm-hmm. you know, maybe not more here in Haynes because we're limited by how many people come here. But overall, I think there'd be, you know, more deaths if it wasn't a guide out there to help you make good judgments.
All right. Thank you very much. It's been a very interesting discussion. I hope that those who are listening have learned some things. Thank you very much, Tracy, for contributing to our wealth of knowledge about how we might approach the issues of land use and regulation in the community. I appreciate that.
Well, thanks for having me, Deborah.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. And thanks very much, Scott, for being with us today.
You're welcome.
And now for everyone's favorite part of the show. Hey, who are you?
Suzanne B.A. Smith.
Well, welcome, Suzanne. Thanks for coming on the show.
Sure, Deborah.
All right. Well, you've been around town a long time, but I want you to tell us, where do you come from? Why are you here? And tell us anything you want us to know about you. That's your 5 minutes.
I come from the East Coast, and I'm here because a long time ago, I think back in 1987, I came up to visit my older sister, Heather Lundy,
mm-hmm.
and her husband. I was living and working in New York City and barely making a living. I loved what I did, but it was rough. I was managing a rare bookshop and doing art on the side.
Wow.
Dressing, anything I could eke out. Anyway, I came up here for a visit in June. People were so nice. I knew I didn't want to stay in New York. I knew I just couldn't cut it financially, you know, pay my rent and I'd have $3 left. I didn't have any family. I was young. I was 26. So I decided to go back, get rid of my apartment, move back with my parents for a little while, and then come up in the spring. And that's what I did. And I've been here
because
since
the people
then.
Were so nice.
Because people were so nice. Yeah.
Most people come because the weather's so nice.
No, and it was beautiful. You know, it was June when I was here, and the weather was great. But the only thing I remember about the weather and how it affected me was that I was so exhausted all the time. And somebody said to me, well, you know, there's a lot more oxygen here than there is in New York City, so maybe I was just overwhelmed with oxygen. But no, it was the people.
Okay, and then there was one special person that you met here.
Yeah, but I didn't meet him for a while. My husband, Norm Smith.
Norm.
And yeah, I met him, and eventually we got married and have a family, and I just feel very fortunate to live here. I love Haynes.
And the rare books, that was interesting. How do you must have a passion for reading.
I love reading. I just love reading, and I feel very strongly about everybody being able to self-entertain themselves rather than look for external sources. And I think that's very important in Haynes. You have to be independent, and I greatly support the library. I love to read. It's just a great activity.
And you are an early morning riser. I do know that.
Yes.
Yeah. And tell me about swimming in the ocean. I often think of, it's not Audrey Hepburn, it's the other Hepburn, Catherine. You're like the Catherine Hepburn of Haynes.
I'd like to get up early, and I like to exercise early, and I generally do it independently. I'm not a big, like, morning muscles person. I would love to be, but I just like doing stuff on my own. So I like to swim.
Early in the morning,
yeah.
In the ocean.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sometimes.
Tell me, have you ever, like, been chased by a fish out there?
Mm-mm. No, it's been really nice. It's short-lived because it is so cold out there, and I don't like wetsuits. So the longest I've ever stayed in swimming out in the bay out front is 13 minutes. That's tops. But I like to, you know, I like to walk, and I love my dogs, and I go to the pool in the winter. Sometimes I jump in the bay in the summer early in the morning, but it's just a nice way to feel refreshed.
Great. Well, thank you very much, Suzanne. Your five minutes is already up.
Okay.
Yeah.
Can I say one more thing?
Sure.
Okay. In spite of the community often being at odds about different political and governmental issues, I would just like to say I think Haynes, when it decides what it wants, gets what it wants. And I believe our values are strong. Just recently, if you look at the fundraisers for sending the boys basketball team to state and Big Brothers, Big Sisters and the Venture Scouts and all those things, people support the kids and the school. And I think that's our greatest resources. So I think we should just keep on doing what we're doing.
Thank you.
Bye.
All right. And that's it for Talk Around Town this week. Thanks for checking in with the Community Matters. Thanks to our guests, Tom Morfitt, Annette Smith, Tracy Knutson, Sunny Sundberg, and Suzanne B.A. Smith. Thanks to Margaret Friedenauer, the KHNS News Director, Production Engineer, and all-around support. We'll be back in 2 weeks. And in the meantime, respect other people's space. You're listening to Station KHNS 102.3 FM, Haynes, Clackamas, and Skagway.